This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Poles Apart, the Consilio podcast where we talk about politics, property and planning news from across the capital. I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
And I'm Luke Francis.
And today we have not one but two very special guests on the show. Our managing director Nick Dines has interviewed former Guardian journalist and founder of the popular London news website On London, Dave Hill. And the interview doesn't talk about the recent London elections or current news, but is an in-depth conversation to talk about Dave's fascinating new book, Olympic Park, When Britain Built Something Big, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But before we get to the interview and start today's episode for the first time, Nick joins us now. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Nathan. It was absolutely fascinating chat with Dave Hill, looking back over the last 20 years of Olympic Park.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the interview.
Yeah,
and this is your first time on the podcast.
Indeed, thank you for having me, guys.
Definitely last. Won't be the last. But as you know, we like to start the podcast by just picking out a couple of stories that have caught our eye this week. So, Luke, what's your story of the week?
Yeah, let's kick off with a good news story. So City Hall announced earlier this week that a record number of new affordable homes were started in the year to March. It was a 41% increase on the previous year. So the new figure is 18,722. Obviously, there was an impact with COVID restrictions and supply chains for the previous year that slowed down delivery. The cloud to that silver lining is that by City Hall's own estimates, there's still quite a long way to go. So last year, City Hall put out a statement saying that they need to start 66,000 new homes each year, of which 43,000 would need to be affordable. So probably not even at 50% in terms of what City Hall's own estimates are. But
heading in the right direction.
Heading in the right direction. And we fully expect to see it ramp up over the next 12, 18 months.
Let's hope so. Nick, what's your story of the week?
The recent opening of Bank Station, which represents a £700 million upgrade by Transport for London, much to the relief of our South London-based team, who've been coming in by various means to get to the office over the past 6 months, our office here in Moorgate. It's interesting the words that were attributed to Sadiq in The Guardian, where it said he's desperate for commuters to return. And to do that, we need to keep investing in public transport to make it as appealing as possible to come back. But I think that also it's reflective of a need for kind of offices to up their game as well to attract people back in. I mean, quite incredibly, Bank is only at 60% of 2019, i.e. pre-pandemic levels.
Really? As low as that?
Incredible amount. And just walking around near our office, you can sense the emptiness. Certainly on a Friday, it is pretty much a
Friday
ghost town.
Friday is still
during
a ghost
the day. However, Friday night, where we went out last week to Shoreditch with the team and felt a bit more like Sodom and Gomorrah than London to me with my 43-year-old eyes. That was a bit of an eye-opener.
You're just showing your age.
Indeed, but that maybe represents the fact that weekend and leisure is at 85% of pre-pandemic levels, which shows people are coming back to central London, just not to work. And there was some other interesting news this week, that the UK tops the table of nations with most staff working from home, which again, you can kind of get that feel, but that's because we have such a high services sector compared to other countries. Countries like Germany historically have a high manufacturing base, which we don't anymore for various reasons too lengthy to go into in this short podcast. But we have a high services sector.
Monday.
No, indeed. But we have a high services sector. Obviously, in London we do. And people just aren't coming back to the office to the same extent.
Do you think that transport costs, I mean, just going on a bit of a riff here, but transport costs maybe factor in part of that as well. You know, people have saved money working from home.
Cost of living, full stop.
But they've saved money working from home, and whether or not actually, you know, they don't want to suddenly spend that money on travel, and maybe that's partly why.
Well, here at Consilio, we're at 3 days a week, and we say, you know, if we went to 5 days a week, I think most of the team, including me, would be, I'm not too happy about this, because, you know, it's become part of our life now. But when you look at the amount of office space there is in and around London, we see Great Portland Estate, a client of ours, Derwent, another client of ours, who are making, you know, real grade A office space with the highest environmental sustainability standards.
It's what people want.
It's what we want for our office supplier. That's going to be the challenge. So substandard office space is probably going to be in trouble over the next year or so.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting times. But Nick, you've interviewed Dave Hill about his book, which is the sort of key interview today, and a bit of an extended interview because it was so fascinating. It couldn't stop you guys talking to each other.
It was a real geek fest on local government in East London over the last 25, 30 years. It was.
But, I mean, the book's described as sort of a fast-paced, in-depth account of how Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park was built in time for London 2012 and how it's developed since. And how was the interview? What are your highlights? What did you think of it?
You know, it was a really enjoyable chat with Dave. Dave's a journalist I've been reading from his time at The Guardian. And obviously he set up On London, which really, to me, is a kind of oracle of local government news in London. Dave is respected across the political field. And it was great to see he'd written a book about the Olympic Park, which is a place I only really discovered probably during the pandemic. When we were all locked down, my wife, daughter and I, we'd get on our bikes.
Oh, you're always having pancakes over there, aren't you?
Well, we died. The Breakfast Club is now a hot spot for us. But we get our bikes, go down the River Lee and head to the Olympic Park and rediscovered what a fantastic place it's become. Mm-hmm. But we have an interesting chat about, you know, who Olympic Park is for, because, mm-hmm. you know, it is an interesting dynamic that, you know, the Olympic boroughs really wanted to have a legacy for their residents.
Yeah.
Has that happened? Or is it Olympic Park for lots of newcomers, people who come from a place in London to live? So we have a debate about that. We go over the full the history of the development of the site, clearing pylons. There are 52 pylons on the site that need to be cleared. Covered every aspect of Olympic Park. I found it fascinating and I hope people listening in do as well.
Well, let's listen to it now.
Yeah. Well, I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Dave Hill, who has written a fantastic magnum opus, Olympic Park, When Britain Built Something Big. Dave, thank you for joining us today. Maybe just introduce yourself to our audience.
Okay, well, my name is Dave Hill, and I am a journalist, and I've been a London specialist in the politics and the sort of general development of the city since 2008, when I wrote about the first mayoral contest mm-hmm. between Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson. Yeah. And after that became addicted to writing about the city and how it changes and why it changes. And I did that for The Guardian for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And I now run my own website called onlondon.co.uk.
Brilliant, which has been a much read about the local elections, which I'm sure lots of people have been talking about. But I'm really delighted to be able to talk to you about the book. When it landed through the letterbox, it's slightly bigger than I thought it would be. I thought it would be a quick read. Oh, no. But it is an absolutely encyclopedic, really. But enjoyable read, kind of look back over the past 20, 30 years of the Olympic dream of various politicians to get the Olympic Games to London.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention the fatness of the book, because it has turned out to be much fatter than I expected it to be when I began writing it. I thought it would be quite a slim volume. But, of course, this was an absolutely enormous enterprise, building the park. It's worth remembering that on that famous night in July 2005, when in Singapore, when the decision was taken that London would be the host city for 2012, even at that point, and even though London had clearly done a decent job of putting a bid together, most people still expected Paris to win it. Mm-hmm. And when London was named as the host city, there was, in Singapore and amongst other people who'd been important to getting the bid together, who were massed in other parts of London to hear the outcome, an initial elation, of course. And then after about half an hour, oh, my God, we've got to do this thing now. Yeah. And so there's a little anecdote in the story. Some of the people who didn't go to Singapore, but who were nonetheless very, very important to putting together the initial master plans and getting the land assembly going and all that incredibly complicated stuff. And they were in a pub just off Trafalgar Square. Mm-hmm. And they had been briefed in advance about what to say to the media when we lost, you know. Yeah. And we, you know, yeah. Was it worth it?
Yes, British attitude, that is.
Absolutely.
We're not going to win
this. So, yeah. Yes, we really feel it was well worth the effort and it's put London on the map and so on and so forth. And then, of course, they won. Mm-hmm. And there was a real sense of shock mm-hmm. about what was going to happen next. And, of course, the next day,
of course,
we had the terrible attacks on mm-hmm. London's tube and the bus. And so there was a lot of disorientation, really, after all that excitement. Oh, my God, what happens next? And then that happened. Mm. People had to sort of gather themselves together. And actually, when you look at the chronology, it is amazing how quickly everything proceeded anyway, you know. And I think whatever quibbles or criticisms you might have of how the park has turned out, the fact that this extraordinary thing was done from a standing start, and it was pretty much already by the summer of 2011 as intended, a year before, a year before the games, astounding, really.
Regeneration appeared to be at the heart of everything in terms of why lots of people backed it, even though they probably thought we're not going to win this, is because it would unlock the regeneration of a huge swathe of Stratford. But looking through the book at the start, it made me think what could have been elsewhere in London. I mean, because London had hosted the games in 1908 and 1948, which I must confess, I don't remember 48. I'd read about 1948, but I couldn't have told you we held the games in 1908. What fascinated me about other areas it could have been, Horace Cutler at the GLC was looking at doing the games at Royal Victoria Dock and working on a feasibility study before Margaret Thatcher and Michael Heseltine said no to that, which appeared to kill it off. But then other sites were looked at for London. Outer West London at RAF Northolt, Pickett's Lock, where I'm an Enfield person, so that would certainly have been interesting, and the disaster that was the World Athletics Championship stadium that fell through at Pickett's Lock, and the Lee Valley. And it appears to Lee Valley because so much regeneration was needed in the area. And in the book, I've written some points here. Unloved, ignored part of London, urban edgeland of fridge graveyards, dumping ground, scary patch, twilight zone, an anomaly where time had stood still. So what's the motivation to win the games for many people? For sporty people it was. But do you think a number of other people are thinking this could actually unlock the investment we need for regeneration?
Well, I think it had become apparent in the last few decisions before the London decision that a good way to win a bid to be a host city was to absolutely link your bid to a big urban regeneration project and say this is going to bring prosperity and better facilities.
Which is what Barcelona was seen as being. Because I read in there that the Birmingham bid review was kind of like, we didn't focus on regeneration, whereas I think the Barcelona Olympics is seen as re-energising the city, wasn't it? So
there was a man at Arup called Mark Bostock, who helped me a lot with the book, who was involved with Birmingham's attempt to win the games. And Barcelona's bid, which he considered to be less good as a sort of technical bid, as he put it, was nonetheless very much framed in terms of rejuvenating that part of the city. And that seemed to be what did the trick for them. Mm-hmm. And that lesson, I think, was learned by a lot of people. Now, the point about could it have been in other parts of London? Well, I think the momentum within the British Olympics establishment and amongst people in London who were trying to work up some enthusiasm for a bid was that they sort of concluded that East London was the place, but they had to sort of look at every possible way of doing it, so that in a sense no one could say, well, you haven't really thought about holding it at Wembley and various established places in other parts of the city. And of course, to do it in East London absolutely ties in with that regeneration thing. I mean, one of the interesting niche bits of my research was simply to discover for how long at national government level serious planning people had been looking at the East London corridor or the Thames Gateway, as it came to be known, saying there's an awful lot of stuff we could do here, and that goes back to the last century. And going further back, you alluded to Horace Cutler, former leader of the Greater London Council. It was a sort of kite-flying exercise, really, in the run-up to the election for the GLC, saying, hey, why don't we try and bring the sort of poor dying docklands? And of course, the docks in London died really fast. How about trying to bid for a game as a way of bringing them back to life, bringing new life? And of course, that kite formed part of legendary 1980 London-based thriller, The Long Good Friday, with Bob Hoskins, where it's sort of alluded to as, you know, there's all this land, you know, as Bob so nicely put it, that stuff can be done with. So, you know, that didn't really happen, although entertainingly, Ken Livingstone at the time, who was, of course, on the politics scene in London, said, "Oh, that's just one of Horace's megalomaniac ideas," he said, and immediately dismissed it. And, of course, a few years later, it was a different story.
It's interesting you mention Ken there, because one of the things it's interesting you read a book, everyone takes different things from it, don't they? A great collective effort from tens of thousands of people to deliver the Olympic Games, but without key individuals pushing forward, it wouldn't have happened. I mean, some names that, you know, Richard Summeray, former Camden councillor, member of the London Council for Sport and Recreation. Yes. No one will know, but it appears right at the start, without his passion and driving force, it wouldn't have got to the next level with Seb Coe getting involved. Mm. They wouldn't have got Ken Livingstone so energised and excited about it. But it appears it needed Tessa Jowell to really unlock this within government, because for the Olympic bid to work, it needed government funding. The Commonwealth Games in Manchester was seen to have been a success. I think that's in terms of the regeneration of that part of Manchester, but also financially. Where the government only provided £100 million financial package for that, which I think when we went to London's numbers were a little bit different. But I think Ken Livingstone said, because he wasn't in the Labour Party at the time, it took Tessa Jowell to kind of convince others in the government to actually back him and back the Olympics bid.
So you mentioned Richard Summeray, who's an important and often overlooked figure in the sort of long journey to get the idea of bidding for the Games on the agenda at all. And he was a councillor in Camden, but he had very good connections with the local government network and with other people. And he evangelised for a Games in East London. He went and talked to Newham Council, which at that time, before Robin Wales and the mayoralty there, weren't interested at all. You know. It was an uphill struggle, but he was very, very determined. And there was at one point a parallel attempt to work up a bid involving Seb Coe, who was obviously absolutely a big name in the Olympics world. And they worked together. And they worked on a bid which was unsuccessful, but Richard felt, I think, you know, we can still build on this. It was done at very short notice, so he's very important, and it was in the end absolutely crucial that national government was brought on board. So Ken Livingstone, the first mayor of London, and everybody in the first year of the existence of the mayoralty saying, what is this job exactly? You know, we've got to do these big, complicated planning strategies and so on and so forth. And what have we got? And what can we do? And they were really sort of making it up as they went along a bit. But there was enthusiasm within the GLA from Neil Coleman, who was an incredibly important person under Ken Livingstone, and then under Boris Johnson, in terms of the Games and the park, and other people at the London Development Agency of that time, Tony Winterbottom, Gareth Blacker, Rosanna Laws, who's still involved with the Olympic Park. And it was a question of sort of getting the right people round the table to start looking seriously at what could be done with the Lower Lee Valley, and then trying to persuade the Labour government at that time, and of course they hated Ken Livingstone when he was first mayor because he'd run as an independent and slaughtered their candidate. How could they be got on side? And Tessa Jowell, as everybody knows, was absolutely crucial to that. She was able to get on with Ken Livingstone, even though they were from the opposite ends of the Labour spectrum at that time. And she was able to persuade other people in government, including Tony Blair, that it was worth going for.
The Olympic bid's won, but the actual delivery then is absolutely fascinating. The pylons, I don't think I've ever read so much about pylons, but there were 52 large pylons completely dominating the site. And it cost over 200 million to get rid of the pylons in 4 metre wide tunnels, which pylons still exist as you go up the River Lee. You didn't really think about that, what could be the biggest barrier to the Olympics, pylons, £200 million. But then you had the private developers who appear to have got on, then not got on, with the Rubens, Stanhope, Chelsfield, LCR. Okay. Is there anything you can maybe say about that and the kind of the private sector involvement in terms of delivering Westfield, another kind of private sector elements of the Olympic Park?
Well, in the foreword, which Sir Peter Hendy has very kindly written for me, because he was, of course, was the TfL commissioner at that time and is now the chair of the LLDC. And he makes the point that it was public and private sector involvement that working together in various ways that was essential to this whole thing happening. Just to dwell on the pylons for a while, I mean, it was almost a sort of forgotten episode at the time. It was really quite difficult to find stuff that had been written about it when it was happening. This was a huge project in its own right.
Yeah.
As you say, there were two rows of pylons owned by two different companies carrying electricity into the area of the park, spanning the what would be the park itself and far up the Lee Valley and in the other direction. And they're owned by private companies, and it's very, very difficult to persuade them that they should be knocked down. Who's going to pay for it? So the whole and it was incredibly difficult to get this story straight, you know, because you're relying on people's memories, and everybody remembers these things slightly differently, even if they were intimately involved with it, you know. But it was a question of, well, let's work up a plan as far as we can, let's get some provisional backing to pay for it, and so on and so forth, and basically London had to be in a position whereby if it did win the bid, it could start work on that straight away, because people could see that it was a huge job. And if you weren't able to start right away, it wasn't going to happen. And you couldn't have these things all over the park, you know. How could you get the cranes in? It would look horrible.
Yeah.
And Westfield, Stratford City, it was all over the land they wanted to use as well. So they had so it needed to go for them to carry on. Now, the power lines and drilling the tunnels under the Lower Lee Valley to put new power lines in, that's an enormous subplot in the Olympic Park story, and so is the creation of Westfield. I think we're going to have this in a condensed form because it's such a complicated story. But there had been an aspiration to redevelop the old, unused railway lands around Stratford Station, broadly speaking.
Just interjection, do you think this would have happened without the Olympics, in terms of Westfield's living? Well, that's why I was reading the book, and I'm a regular visitor to Westfield. Was one needed for the other in terms of the Olympics of Westfield to actually happen?
Some people will say that Westfield, Stratford City would never have happened without the Olympics, and other people say that the Olympics would never have happened without Westfield, Stratford City, and they will also tell you that none of it would have happened without High Speed 2, you know, which is this other big infrastructure thing that was going through the territory as well. To cut a long story short on the developer antagonisms to do with what became Stratford City, you ended up with a consortium of four developers and London and Continental Railways, which was a company that was set up by the government and partly funded by the government, and was responsible for, among other things, making use of land that was no longer needed after the privatisation of the British Rail, I think. And the developers that all had a stake in this could not stand each other. They couldn't agree on who should be in charge. It was a truly terrible relationship between these people. And there was a famous meeting called by Robin Wales, Mayor of Newham, who was absolutely, absolutely determined to have this development done. He could see it was a great thing for Newham, and he called them all into his office basically to knock heads together and find out what is going on. And I've spoken to him and two other people who were at that meeting, three other people who were at that meeting, in fact. And it was just an astonishing scene of people shouting abuse at each other and metaphorically, mm-hmm. I think, throwing chairs at each other. And Robin Wells just basically threw them all out. And at the end of the day, the issue really, really had to be forced. It was forced by Westfield, who, after a fashion, bought everybody out. Mm-hmm. Ken Livingston was quite a lot involved in this. He was famously extremely rude mm-hmm. about the Rubin brothers, yep. which was one of the consortium. And he maintains that he deliberately was very rude about them because they hated publicity and that would mm-hmm. see the back of them. I don't know whether that's true or not. That's what he says. A long, tangled, and rather riveting tale, but it boiled down to, you know, a trial of strength between the main consortium partners and Westfield won out.
And a Westfield who kept investing throughout the credit crunch, which many people didn't. And the next phase for me in the book, as we move the story along chronologically, came to me about money. Mm. There was a lot of scepticism about the costs. It looks like around $9.3 billion was what was eventually admitted might be the cost. Where we got to, I don't know at the end. But $750 million spent on CPOs minimum. There, these numbers are starting to add up. And then in the middle of this, Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Becomes mayor of London. And something he said stood out to me when he was in Beijing. It's very, very important to remember that we won the games at a time of economic plenty, and we must deliver it against the background of credit crunch, a downturn, and possible recession. And to the extent the Olympic Village was actually paid for out of the public purse at a cost of $1.1
billion.
Yes. I mean, these are huge sums of money, and there must have been some pressure at the time, I'd imagine. With all this public money going in, are we going to be able to deliver what we promised?
Yes, well, there were two large individual building projects which were, in theory, going to be built by the private sector, paid for by the private sector, effectively. And one was the Village, which was was sort of part of Stratford, part of Stratford City originally. It's all very... That's another complicated part of the story, but that ended up being basically paid for out of the Olympic budget. And the other one is what is now known as Here East, and Here East was the two media centre buildings, the press centre and the broadcast centre, which they were going to be built with private money, and then they were going to be knocked down, and they weren't going to be knocked down, and on and on and on, various debates about what should happen to them. But in the end, you and I stumped up to build them. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of glorious episode around the time of the games themselves when Boris Johnson put his conservative ally Daniel Moylan at the top of the legacy organisation, and Daniel was dead set against what became Here East happening. In other words, the media buildings being turned into this sort of tech hub for employment and innovation and so on. He wanted them knocked down and beautiful housing built there. Mm-hmm. And just about nobody agreed with Daniel. Daniel knows his own mind, and he pushed and he pushed and he pushed, and in the end he was pushed out by a combination of Boris and Neil Coleman.
Yeah.
And Here East happened.
Indeed. And it's thriving now. I mean, we regularly go to the Breakfast Club on the bottom there, and it's very trendy and cool now, isn't it?
Indeed. People will tell you that they think it has been a fabulous success, actually. It was very difficult to imagine who was going to move in there. So Margaret Ford, who was the chair of the Olympic Park Legacy Company.
Lots of acronyms and titles in this book. There's a lot in there.
I was struggling there for a moment, wasn't I? But that was the first legacy body that was set up. And she told me, and it's in the book, she said, I thought somehow we would work out what was going to happen with the stadium, but I could not think what we were going to do with these two big empty buildings. Jules Pipe, the then mayor of Hackney, now of course the planning chief under Sadiq Khan, insisted that he, because it's in Hackney, And he really wanted the Here East vision, really, to come to fruition. And Margaret said, you know, I was sure Jules was wrong, but actually he turned out to be absolutely right about it. So
yeah, and one other legacy piece, which gets mentioned a lot in the book, is the Olympic Stadium. Yeah. There's a lot of pages on the Olympic Stadium and the costs and the spiralling costs of the stadium. As a Tottenham season ticket holder who plays very inflated prices, I must admit I was slightly miffed when I saw West Ham's rent started at £2.5 million a year to a £600 million stadium. But again, looking back, that was hugely controversial for the past 15 years in terms of a stadium and what was going to happen to it. Demolished athletic stadium, it's ended up as a football stadium. Fascinating stuff.
It is interesting because so my book doesn't attempt to name the guilty men and or women because there
too many to mention. Or?
there are a lot of people who were sort of intimately involved with getting the park built who will say to you off the record, if only X hadn't done Y in year Z, you know. If only, you know. Only. Mm. And you can sort of see what they mean, but you can also see how what did happen happened. There are people who've said on the record, I mean, Robin Wells again, Richard Caborn, who was the sports minister, who disagreed with Tessa Jowell at the time, who felt that right at the beginning there was a deal to be done with the then owners of West Ham. But other people just didn't feel it was solid enough. And in fact, I mean, this story found its way into the media. But only, I think it was a couple of months after that story came out, and Richard Caborn was saying, you know, we're having very serious conversations about West Ham having this stadium, and we'll follow the Manchester City model, the Commonwealth Games model. Which I think was what they would have had in mind. But soon after that, the ownership changed. And actually, right up until they were putting the piles into the ground for the stadium, which was just after Boris Johnson, around the time Boris Johnson was elected, there was still debate about what kind of stadium this ought to be and could be. But the feeling on the ODA side was that it just wasn't solid enough from a football club at that time to take that approach. So they basically made it an athletic stadium, which we'll do something with later. And that's when it got much more expensive and very complicated.
The conversion costs hundreds of millions of pounds. That's quite remarkable. The sums of money are just amazing.
It is sort of a different stadium now, you know. And so what do you make of it? I mean, it's losing money. It requires public subsidy. A lot of people are outraged about that, and you can see why. It's a, from West Ham's point of view, it's a...
Fantastic deal from West Ham's point of view.
It's a nice deal. You know... different decisions might have been taken at certain points, but you could see why the ones that were taken were taken. I think the sort of optimistic view of where we've ended up is that the stadium draws big crowds to watch football matches. Other stuff goes on there, and yes, it's losing money, but the fact of its existence is kind of good marketing for London. And had it had the original plan been seen through to fruition, which was to basically knock it down and have a sort of a shallow bowl for 20,000 people, whatever it was, just for athletics. So again, Margaret Ford talking to Tessa Jowell, saying, "Look, Tessa, you know, we've got this beautiful park, we've got this fabulous shopping centre, and we're going to have this miserable dust bowl in the middle of it." Which is hardly ever going to be used. It's going to drag the whole thing down. We've got to make something of the stadium. And so it's, while we might be dismayed by the way the stadium has turned out, you also have to try and imagine what it would have been like if we'd knocked it down.
Something you said is interesting there. It's because in the books, Robin Wells, in kind of endorsing Newham's financial backing of the stadium, bid and say, yes, it's worth taxpayers' money. Mm. It's the legacy for Newham. There'll be lots of benefit for Newham from there. And but then you mentioned it's a benefit to London.
Yes.
And this just brings me on to kind of, I'm certainly not a revisionist historian. I think clearly, you know, regenerating an area is for the good. It's clearly better than what it was 20 years ago. But I noticed the Olympic boroughs, which was the four East London boroughs involved in the park, yes, plus Greenwich, who were hosting some events, had a framework which was a wish to wed the physical regeneration of the area with a social and economic enrichment of its communities. Mm. And to me, this is still the big debate. Mm. That it is a fantastic place. I go to my family, I go shopping, we go to the park, we visit the cafes and restaurants. Economic enrichment of its communities. I do wonder sometimes. And I think this is a live debate, isn't it? It's what is the legacy of Olympic Games for the communities of Hackney, Newham, Tower Hamlets and Waltham Forest? There's lots of people have moved into the area. Lots of shops moved into the area. Lots of economic activity. We've got the cultural quarter coming. The museum. It's still going to be fantastic. But for those existing communities, has it done what it said it was going to do you think?
I think the coward's answer to that question is... this is actually extremely difficult to measure. Mm. So those boroughs, they you mentioned their framework, and they talked about convergence, which in a funny way is a sort of precursor of levelling up. The idea was that they would try to that the games would be a catalyst for elevating the economic and social health and well-being of people in the poor East London boroughs to the London average. Various metrics to do with health, schools, performance, wages and so on. And for a few years they had a unit that measured all these things and tried to get a fix on what the Olympic project had done for people in those boroughs. And you could, even when that work was being done, I kept an eye on it and I looked at it and I thought, okay, this is interesting, but how do you separate out the Olympics bit from all the rest of the stuff that's happening? So, as we know, high housing costs result in people shifting outwards, and they did that anyway. You know, it's long established patterns of population migration in London going on, you know, forever, of people looking to buy a bigger place, so they move somewhere out. Yes, they have children, and so on and so forth. So you did have an influx of more affluent people, and you still have an influx of more affluent people into, you know, Plaistow is a place where young couples look for a cheap house or whatever. So in terms of schools, you could say that the improvement in school performances in Newham is partly to do with pushy middle class parents, you know, and school teachers in, you know, I've lived in Hackney for years, six children educated in Hackney schools, and whisper it, when you get to know the head teachers quite well, they will say to you, we need a few pushy middle class parents, you know, to get to crack the whip a bit and complain if stuff isn't good enough. So, you know, there are all these factors. So how do you separate out an Olympics effect? And then we had austerity, didn't we? So the one of the things that's changed so much in the last over the last 10 years is that in the run-up to the games, Labour were right behind it, and so were the Tories. And when the coalition government, the Lib Dem Tory coalition, came to power in 2010, yes, they wanted to prune a bit out of the budget, but they were right behind it. You know, they really wanted to do it, and London was held up as this great national asset. Now, of course, we're the bad boys. The bad boys. Nobody loves us.
No one likes London anymore,
But austerity cuts to local government budgets and so on arguably undid some of the things that the Olympic Park might have done for local people. So, and then there's this whole other dimension. It's the sort of, which fascinates me, and it's not something you can measure very easily, but the sort of psychology of the park. So I've been anecdotes from people working in and around the park, local people, very local people, who sort of think the park isn't for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they think it's too nice, it's too posh. You know, we can't go there, we can't afford it. They think you've got to pay to get in. Of course, you don't have to pay to get in. You just turn up and wander around. You know, you'd have to pay to use the velodrome or to go swimming, but you could go to the park just like you can Hyde Park or Regent's Park. It's free. So there's a sense in... And the park authorities are very, very mindful of this, you know, and have the need to sort of... for there not to be a kind of...
More like a them and us.
A them and us, a dividing line or a feeling that the... This is the people look back at Canary Wharf to say this is how it shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. That you want people who live locally to feel that the park really does belong to them, and I think that's still probably a work in progress. Actually,
no, I would have gone with regular visitors, as I said, and I, you know, plenty of places to get a £5 latte, but you know, it does feel a bit that way rather than something for everyone to enjoy a little bit still.
But I think but the legacy of the park is still very much evolving, mm-hmm. and I think the East Bank development, this extraordinary cultural and education quarter, mm-hmm. Which was, Boris Johnson must get some credit for this, he called it Olympicopolis, and he put a lot of oomph behind it, and Sadiq Khan, it's now called East Bank, some changes have been made, but it's still basically the same idea. Got UCL campus there, V&A East. It's going to be our...
Very exciting, isn't it?
It's going to be our exhibition road. Yeah. And the various institutions that are involved in that are making big efforts to reach out to schools and local community groups to say, look, you know, this is coming and it's for you. You know, it is for you. And don't think it isn't.
No, it's very exciting. And well, Dave, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I'd recommend everyone gets the book. Sets aside a bit more time than I had planned. It is a big one. The biggest thing for me was also learning why we have the River Lee and the Lee Navigation spelt differently. But I will not give away the secrets of the book. That to me was fascinating. Where can people buy the book?
Okay, well, it's important information because it's an entirely self-published, self-financed book. And the only place... you can get it really is through my website onlondon.co.uk. Mm-hmm. So if you go there, there's a little button which says shop. Click on that and you'll see the link. That's where to buy it. You can also buy it in the New London Architectures Gallery in Stratford City and at my local bookshop, which is called Pages of Hackney. And earlier today, I gave them one free copy saying, I said, no one will buy this, but I love you, so you can have it for nothing. Earlier today, they said, guess what? We've sold it. So I'm going to have to give them another one. So basically, it's through the website and not Amazon or any other bookshops.
Well, for anyone interested in planning, development, local government and sporting history, I certainly recommend this book. And Dave, thank you for your time today.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all from us today. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to subscribe and, crucially, buy Dave Hill's new book.
Absolutely. Speak soon, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.